So essentially, kind of like in Fallout, how you've got the little your little figure that shows you, oh, your arm's broken, this, whatever. So they're essentially the same thing is what pops up for Jason, and in this scenario, his head is like a very dark orange. So even his interface is firing off like, bro, you are not good right now.
Yeah, specifically, you are not good in the head. And I think
And
it's very useful for his ability to be able to
Jason,
pinpoint where it is.
I say Jason not good in the head. That's a that's a that's kind of his thing.
You're not human. That's her. My thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to this episode of the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I'm D. Allen.
And I'm Donnie B. How are we doing today?
I'm doing good, brother. We are on episode 3 already.
Yes, we are, dude. It feels good, man. It feels good.
It feels good. Things are heating up for Jason. He's been knocked out several times, and this is yet another one. In fact, the end of the last chapter, he was knocked out. We wake up, and Jason has a concussion, essentially, that feels like a face full of bees, which is great imagery. And we get good descriptions of the cage that he's in. They describe it as like a dog cage. It's dirty, he's on the floor. And it's a really good use of just descriptive language. And as ever, I feel like I'm gonna say it on every chapter, but I love his chapter intros. He knows how to start a chapter.
He really does too. One of my favorite things about this chapter is, he wakes up, you get all this great imagery, and he's just in a cage throwing up on himself. He is
Yeah.
got a very brutal concussion. And I think at this point, he's just suffering brain trauma. I mean, he has passed out so many times. He's been hit in the face twice with a shovel. Can't be good for you. And the level of head trauma that he has suffered is significantly more than any normal person should suffer on a day. And to top it all off, he's in a cage in a cellar.
He is. And speaking of the head trauma, we get another quick little look into his interface system. We see an image of, essentially kind of like in Fallout, how you've got the little your little figure that shows you, oh, your arm's broken, this, whatever. So they're essentially the same thing is what pops up for Jason. And in this scenario, his head is like a very dark orange. So even his interface is firing off like, bro, you are not good right now.
Yeah, specifically, you are not good in the head. And I think
And
it's very useful for his ability to be able to
Jason,
pinpoint where it is.
I say Jason not good in the head. That's a that's kind of his thing.
Yeah. Now the question is his antics later in the books related directly to the head trauma that he suffers now? Is his
Bro.
brain gone so hardcore so fast that it changes him forever?
Okay, so I feel like this is a story trope, though, in general, because there are so many different stories I've seen where, within a few years of it coming out, there's almost always a fan theory about, oh, is it all a dream? Is it all a blah, blah, blah? So literally he's waking up concussed and confused. So, maybe his apartment did actually blow up and it is all just his dying dream because he was just a freaking no life gamer. And I'm willing to bet if you do 5 minutes of research, you could probably find an article just like that about this series somewhere.
Oh, probably. We'll hit the Reddit page later and we'll find one.
Oh, I guarantee. Guarantee, yeah. Someone has already come up with the is it all a dream theory.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, any fantasy in general, I feel like there's always like, is it head trauma or is it really happening?
Right.
So, it's at this point when he's vomiting all over himself, face full of bees and whatnot, that he realizes he's not alone. There are other cages.
There are four other cages, to be exact.
There are four other cages. Who might be in those cages?
Well, we know for sure at this point, as a reader, we know that we've got the classic team of Rufus, Farrah, and Gary. And then we also find Anissa in these cages, who right from the start is a total prick and will continue to be a total prick the entire time.
For real.
Before we even know her name, like, she is obviously just an absolute piece of work here. And we don't even get her name for another couple paragraphs.
Yeah, we don't. So, okay, this is something about myself that annoys me when I'm listening to a story, because I actually have a really good suspension of disbelief. So stuff like this, like when looking back, it's like, oh, this is like very obviously foreshadowing to the fact that like she's not a good character and she's probably up to something. Everyone else is being chill. She's being a prick. But I swear I get so into this, like, I mean, my disbelief gets suspended quite well when I'm in a good series. And so I don't even think to analyze as I'm going through. And especially with Shirtalone, like, I get so wrapped into just the story that even though I have a very analytical breakdown of story kind of mind, I get lost in it. I don't even think to do it. And then in hindsight, I'm like, oh, I never saw that coming, because I'm just so lost in it that I don't think about it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we knew right from here that Anissa was going to be just a bad person, you know? But we wouldn't know how bad till much later. And, you know, when they do find her in the astral space with the Builder cult, you know, later on, I'm like, hey, that's Anissa. That's that same person, like, just would not have connected the dots, you know.
The freaking DiCaprio meme.
Yes. That's what I was going for.
Yeah. For real. Every time. Yes. And I feel like that there's so much foreshadowing in Shirtalune's work that, like, to be fair, it's not hard to miss, because some foreshadowing is literally like an item in an inventory.
Yeah, come on, it's, man, just a passing reference at something. And we've talked about this before. We'll talk about it again. It's just like you find a passing reference at something or an implication of something that has much greater effects in the future. Mm-hmm. So it is. It's very easy to just blow past something as, oh, that's something cool, and not even think about it.
Yeah, so after that, though, he notices that there's other cages, and he sees a couple humanoid figures, and he then sees a large hairy figure, and thus starts a bit of what we see essentially everywhere in this series, is pop culture references, specifically kind of between the late 70s on into like the early 90s, I would say are the bulk of them. I would assume probably something that Shirtalune or his family was into, like the stuff that he was into in his own childhood. But the comment that is made here is he sees a big hairy figure and he says, a Wookiee? And the character we meet just after that, Rufus, says, what's a Wookiee?
Right. And that's one of those things, the first time I was reading it, you know, it's a funny thing, right? Just a Wookiee? because he's this big hairy lion man, and you know, reading through it, I have one of two theories. This is either the start of Jason's humor, because he does this all the time throughout the series.
Yeah.
It could also be, going back to our dream state theory, just his head trauma in general making him actually think he was seeing a Wookiee and connecting that. Yeah. It's like, hey, there's a guy with a lot of hair. That's got to be a Wookiee, right? And his concussion's like, yeah, that's absolutely a Wookiee. That's what you're seeing right now.
And that is another point for team. Is this all his dying dream?
Yes.
He was live wearing action Darth Vader with boxers. Wookiees. He was wearing Darth Vader boxers, and now we've got a Star Wars reference again. Mm-hmm. It's definitely his dying dream. I'm on team dying dream now, 100%.
Interesting. Yeah.
No.
But yes, as you mentioned, Rufus, he's really the main one that talks during this exchange. Anissa butts in a couple of times, but Rufus is the leader of their group. He's going to take charge in this conversation, try and figure out who Jason is, try and guide him through being conscious, pretty much.
Right.
This is where we get one of my favorite lines, probably in the whole series. This pops up into my head so often. And Rufus is asking about a suppression collar. You know, he asked Jason, did they put a collar on you? Jason's like, what? And then we get this line, Jason's thoughts refuse to walk in a straight line. And the imagery in that sentence alone, it's like, I just imagine his thoughts all single file. And one guy at the front being like, come on, let's line up. And everybody scatters.
Okay, and that line right there is how I know for a fact Sherdaloon is a Douglas Adams fan.
Yeah. Because that is the very first time.
So Douglas Adams could spin a metaphor like no other.
Yes.
You know, the ships hung in the sky, much in the same way that bricks don't, you know? Like,
yes.
This is the same kind of reference right there. It's like, you know, his thoughts just wouldn't stay in a straight line. Or what was it?
Jason's thoughts refuse to walk in a straight line.
Yeah, there you go. They refuse to walk in a straight line. And that's, 100%. That is a Douglas Adams branded freaking metaphor. And I'm here for it because obviously.
Yes. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the bricks metaphor, because every time I see a line like this, I think of Douglas Adams, and that is the first quote that ever comes to my mind from him.
Right.
Every single time I compare anybody to Douglas Adams, it's the ships hung in the air in the same way, much in the same way bricks don't.
You know, to be honest, though, the main Douglas Adams quote that constantly runs through my head, it's from book two, and Zaphod says... So he's talking to a character, and the character says, you know, you could be a little more cool about it. He's like, you want cool? I'm so cool, you can keep a sight of meat in me for a month. I'm so hip, I have difficulty seeing over my own pelvis.
I say that a lot, too.
That is my favorite Douglas Adams quote. And it's just that same twisty metaphor that he was just so good for, and you love to see another author do something even somewhat like that in their work. And Sherdaloon makes that he does, like, I want to pay attention, because he does a really good job at metaphor like that, not as consistently, well, because obviously at that point this would be a completely different series, but
yes, it would.
But it's 100% an homage, I think.
I agree. And we'll point it out every time it happens, because it's beautiful.
Yeah, and so a fun thing about Rufus, if you know anything about like the hero's journey, Rufus is kind of the mentor character in at least book one of this series. Rufus is like, you know, the typical mentor
the character. The Miyagi, if you will.
Yeah, the Miyagi. But yes, the mentor character in the hero's journey for Jason. So Rufus is constantly helping Jason, but also reprimanding him and whatnot. And that starts out the first, I mean, literally the first interaction, there's already some mentoring kind of going on, you know, because he runs a school.
You don't say.
But he's asking about the suppression collars. Like, oh, they didn't give you one? And he's like, no. And, you know, so it's a bit of a moment of, like, Rufus assessing Jason, what he is, who he is, and, like, kind of already getting his mentor eagle eyes going on Jason.
Yeah, he is, too, because Rufus, as we find out a little bit later, you know, Rufus has seen Outworlders before. He's encountered them before, and, you know, he has the instincts of a teacher. And Jason is this new person introduced, obviously not doing too great. And I think subconsciously at this point, something in Rufus is telling him, hey, maybe this guy is someone in need of mentorship. Maybe he's, at the very least in this moment, in need of guidance, you know?
Right.
Because, you know, we talk about the suppression collars. He's like, why would they put a collar on me? I'm not a dog. And so there's obviously that, you know, immediate, why would they put a collar on me? That's going to trigger something in his subconscious. Like, what do you mean? Why would they put a collar on suppression collars?
Right. That's right. A thing. Right. And so, and I mean, and that's a peek into, at least for the rest of the party that we're going to meet. It's a bit of peek into how much Jason just doesn't know about this world, and like literally like the fact that he is like being thrust into a whole situation where he has zero footing. And this actually, I think, does play into that Nietzsche ideology of the Superman, in that it's that will to power. So effectively, when Jason finds himself unable to find footing in his surroundings, which this happened, you know, this is a constant thing in the series.
Yeah.
He instead seeks power in one form or another, be it literal or metaphorical, you know, a distraction, a disadvantage, or this or that. And I think that is at least a little bit a nod to that, you know, Nietzsche philosophy of him being the Superman. And I think, you know, given that I feel like the entire character of Jason is molded around that, we're going to see a lot of these little things that line up with that ideology.
Oh, yeah, for sure we are. In the meantime, Jason throws up and passes out again.
Yes, he does. And that seems to be a trend. I don't know if he saw that on TikTok or something. Probably not the safest trend. He's
killing that trend, though, but...
terrible.
So being asleep again, after learning suppression collars are a thing, and explaining he has no power, he wakes up again, and this time he wakes up to more people in the room. And this is actually where we meet Cressida Vane, and we re-meet Dougal. This dude is popping up everywhere. This is the third time we see Dougal. Well, third time we experience Dougal. The first time we just heard his voice.
Dougal is only a man that can be experienced. You know what I'm saying?
I feel that. I really do feel that, you know?
Yeah, so this is actually like literally just more dumb luck that on his part, because he completes a bonus objective in a quest just by hanging out, hearing these two people talk.
Yeah, this was one of the first quests he ever got too. This is the same quest as defeat 10 lesser monsters. He had to figure out why the monsters were in the area in the first place. And just by overhearing the conversation of Cressida and Dougal deducing that Landomir's summoning went wrong and that's why there must be creatures here, he managed to complete this quest.
Right. It was the why the creatures were there. And that quest, by the way, was the No Shirt, No Shoes, No Service titled quest. And by his dumb luck, overhearing this, he completes the quest and it is granted a shirt. But at the moment, he doesn't do anything about that shirt.
Because he's still trying to pretend to be unconscious.
Yeah.
And so because probably his big screen flashing in front of his face. Like, hey, you got right. a shirt. He's like, shut up. I'm trying to hide.
Right. A screen which he doesn't yet know that no one else can see. So he's like,
yeah.
You know, in his mind, this is like pulling your phone out in a movie theater.
Yeah, straight up. It's like, hey, what was that?
Oh, sorry. Hey, down in front.
Yeah.
Down in front. Can you not? No, not at all. So they continue their conversation, and we find out that after Landomir died, they chucked his body in the mulch pile, and I find that hilarious because... Yes. Because he was, like, a really full of himself kind of guy. So much so that he thought he could, like, summon the freaking builder by himself with, like, you know, just as a side project, essentially.
Right.
And, nope, gets stabbed by the, you know, the thing that brought him. And then his dad literally, stepdad? Maybe
actually. No, his actual dad.
His actual dad literally just throws him in the trash.
Yeah, that kills me, because Cressida married into the family, and Landomir is her son, and her dad is like, he's my own flesh and blood. My eldest son. Mulch. Fuck it.
Yeah, you had that backwards, actually. He married in.
Yo, you're right.
Yeah.
He married into the family, but it's still his son.
It is still his son.
And he's a part of the blood cult. He should still have those same traditions. Or at the very least, the reverence for your own blood.
Let's not point too many fingers at him, though, because the very next thing that happens is Cressida says, take him out so we can chop him up and eat him.
Yeah. To be fair, that is a perfectly respectable thing in the blood cult. And I actually had this written down during all of this, because we learn a little bit about the blood cult, and it's like the rest of the world, including the readers, us, you know, see this as this evil cult, you know, and this dark cannibalistic, you know, dark god worshiping cult. And it's like, to them, they're like, yeah, we're into stuff you don't like. I mean, this is like perfectly normal. It's the same way that Jason for a while used the dark essence, you know, we saw that while he was contemplating using it, you know, it's the dark essence, it's dark magic. And to them, it's like, no, we just like blood magic. You don't like that, but we like that.
Dog, you're comparing cannibalism to, like, oh yeah, I don't really watch that show, it's not my thing.
I mean,
my guy, it's cannibalism.
On the grand scale of things, it kind of is, because to them, cannibalism is not a bad thing, right? Because they're gonna chop him up and eat him, specifically because that is the best way to honor his blood in their religion, right?
I mean, is that specifically stated? They could just be fucking weird.
I don't know, Cressida says, we're a nice traditional blood cult family. And he may have been worthless, but he was still my son. So mulching is obviously it's less reverent than chopping and eating.
Well, I mean, yeah, throwing anybody's body in the trash is going to be less reverent than most things. But I don't know if I would necessarily consider cannibalism to be reverent. But hey, to each their own, we ain't judging over here.
You judge pretty hard.
No, never.
Never. I'm just saying, they don't... There's always a good and evil, and the good and the evil depends on which side you're on. The bad guys don't think they're the bad guys.
This is true. No one ever thinks they're the villain.
Yeah.
In Jason's case, though, he does kind of understand that they're the villains, because as they're having their conversation, Cressida is like, you know, kind of grilling him like, okay, well, first off, why does he not have a shirt? Second off, you know, what did you learn about him? Third, why is there no collar on him? You know, she's kind of grilling him, like, dude, what the fuck? What even is this? And he's like, I don't know. He showed up without a shirt. He looks weak as hell. I didn't have a collar, bro. What can I say? And then in regards to the information, she's like, well, did you talk to him? And he said, I don't know. He walked into my shovel, which I think is hilarious because he is probably one of the smartest characters in the series because Jason's biggest weapon is his mouth, and Dougal's like the only guy, I think, in the series that just stops him from talking.
Yeah. Yeah, straight up. He's like, I don't suppose you guys are cannibals. Not even going to acknowledge it, fucking shovel.
Right. Just like, yeah, no.
Dude, what do you just... Shovel.
Shovel.
And then his tact in this situation, you know, it's like, I didn't rough him up. He looked like that. Where's his shirt? I don't know. He didn't have a shirt. What'd you learn about him? Not much. He just kind of walked into my shovel.
Twice.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, did he say anything back? Like, not really. He walked into my shovel again.
Yeah.
It's like, dude just kept walking into my shovel. I don't
know. Listen, as previously discussed, Dougal takes his gardening skills very seriously.
Yes. Speaking of which, every single time we see Dougal up until this point, he has a gardening implement. Something, right? Because in the, when we overhear him in the hedge maze, he's talking about the fact that he just lost a trowel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the plant just took his trowel. He shows up in the ritual chamber with a shovel.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a couple paragraphs here, he's going to show back up with a shovel. The question is Dougal like really a big bad, or is he just an evil gardener?
He's 100% an evil gardener.
He just happens to be the head of the gardeners, and he is involved.
He's like legit, just like the groundskeeper of the Vein Estate.
Yeah,
but like also still part of the blood cult, because like you can't just post a job posting like, hey, you wanna maintain the lawn of a blood? Well, okay, maybe you can.
In the right circles, I'd imagine, yeah.
I'm sure it happens. Who am I kidding?
But he like appears to be like high up in the ranks, like personal assistant to Cressida or something. Like, no, he's just a groundskeeper, happened to be in the right place at the right time.
You know, and qualified for the blood cult, given that he's a cannibal.
Yeah, also true. And it is at this point, after he explained that Jason walks into his shovel a couple of times. This is the moment that defines, in my opinion, that defines the entire series. This is the most important line in the entire book, in the entire series, in the entire history. This line being, when Cressida, so Dougal asks if they want to mulch the new kid, right? Jason.
Hmm.
And Cressida says, if he really did kill my son, I don't want him trotting off to death with his soul intact. Giving the implication that he's going to be now part of the sacrifice, allowing Dougal to take one of the others for his own. We'll get into that in a sec. But this decision right here, if Cressida had said, yeah, take Jason to the kitchen, let's cut him up, none of the rest of this would have ever happened. This is the moment that puts him in the right place at the right time to survive, to get the rest of the party free, and to become the Jason Asano that we know. There is absolutely no way at all, if he was taken away right now, he could have escaped, and no way he could have survived.
Two thoughts on that.
Go ahead.
First off, I think that has a big deal to do with his interface, you know, the mysterious stranger ability, more than likely. How so? Because... So I want to say it's mentioned way later by Shade that, like, the interface has got, you know, some, like, future-predicting capabilities in some capacity, right? Not specifically, but, like, it has some ability to look into the future. So, essentially, it could be the quest system lining up his quests to set him up for the right set of events, that puts him in the position to be saved. Because if he would have just been found on the estate, for example, not even ran into Landomir, just running around naked in the hedge maze, 100% he's locked in a cage in the kitchen. She doesn't care. No one cares. The only reason she cares is because he killed Landomir.
True. But she didn't have to make him a sacrifice.
She didn't have to. But back on what you were saying about, you know, the honorable thing and blah, 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 and their tradition with the blood cult, this is more an act of vengeance.
It is.
And also knowing, though, that the soul is going to be affected in this ritual, not just the body. And that is, you know, that's her important point here, is like, nah, screw this guy. It's not a kitchen, you know, it would be a waste to kitchen this guy. No, we have to burn his soul.
Yeah. And it is that act of vengeance and that act of pride that saved Jason's life and put him on the path to becoming an astral king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is a solid moment. And for my second point, I also think that it is another slight representation of that Nietzsche theology. In that, so like the Superman, Nietzsche's Superman, like the theory behind it is that anybody can be a Superman. It just takes the right set of circumstances. And I think that is essentially what we're witnessing here in this story in relation to that Nietzsche theology. This is, you know, the right set of circumstances setting him up to be that Superman and, you know, gain all that power and ideally not lose himself while he's fighting monsters, you know?
It is 100%. Yeah. Yes. This is the moment where he actually has a chance of achieving that. And being in the right place at the right time with the right decisions being made is all a part of that philosophy. And this is where we really see that happen. And it's never explained. It's just kind of a blowover moment. You know, it's a classic villain wanting to create the most amount of pain. But without that, the Superman isn't possible. I feel like a lot of people that didn't know Nietzsche, that doesn't read Nietzsche, you know, even the little bit that I've read, you're absolutely right. Like, this is that moment, that right circumstance that he needs.
So, and this is another thing that I was thinking about this entire exercise in that Nietzsche philosophy. Beyond anything, this could just be a vehicle for, you know, Schertelun to deliver that theology to the public in a more digestible fashion than something written, you know, almost 200 years ago. I don't know the exact dates, but it's quite a long time ago, written in a very dry, you know, studious way, a very lecture hall kind of way. So it doesn't, you know, and then translated from German to English. So just in general, it doesn't read the best, you know? Right. So that could be his entire motivation here, is like, yo, I think this philosophy is really cool, and I think it blah, 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 carries some connotations that are important at this point in society. And so that, theoretically, that could be what, I mean, that's what I feel Schertelun may be up to with the Nietzsche thing.
Absolutely. It's genius.
Yeah.
So having the Nietzsche out of the way, they kind of agree that they've gotten all the conversation that they can here. And in your classic standalone short story, all of the prudent information being delivered, we see Dougal and Cressida leave the room. Because why wouldn't they?
Right.
This is giving them a chance, giving the cage people a chance to talk. Rufus explains the usage of spirit coins. Which is kind of funny because the way I read through it, you know, Rufus is like, yeah, we're just going to be sacrificed unless you've got a spirit coin hanging around. And Jason's like, well, yeah, I've got one of those. What is that going to do?
Yeah, like, right.
This cage isn't coin operated, is it? Because I've got one of those.
it's coin operated to a degree.
It is actually a little bit, considering the amount of things in this universe that are coin operated. Not be surprised if a cage.
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised either, but I was getting more at the fact that in the literal sense that he pops a coin and he gets out of the cage. It's
that is
theoretically
true.
Coin operated.
I guess on the most technical sense of it, it is actually coin operated.
However, we get one of Shirtaloon's personal tropes in this moment, because before he even gets that door open, Rufus explains the coin to him, and he's like, all right, cool. Puts one on his tongue, and it dissolves. He gets the rush of power. Ah! He doesn't do anything. And then we get what I consider to be a bit of a Shirtaloon trope, where there's just these banter dialogues that happen constantly through the series. And this is kind of, I think, the first example of it.
It is absolutely the first example of it.
So Rufus goes, Jason? Jason's like, yes, Rufus? And like, just that, like, the Jason, yes, whoever he's responding to, like, setup style of banter is a big thing, kind of Shirtaloon's signature thing, you know. Jason? Yes, Rufus?
Yes.
You didn't take that coin and do nothing, did you? Yeah, I got distracted.
Yeah. And this beautiful, too, because with the amount of explanation and the scenery that Shirtaloon has set here, you know, we understand why Jason's distracted. You know, everything rushes in. He's got this immense power inside him. You know, colors are more vibrant. He can hear things. He can smell things. You know, he basically put a coin on his tongue, and now he's in a whole new world, experiencing things he'd never thought he could experience.
Right.
Yeah, to anybody who doesn't know about magic, that's pretty distracting. I would be distracted, too.
Right, just like, yeah, you just experience the world at a whole nother level.
Yeah. And this is where we get two very opposing comments on this experience. Because Jason gets distracted, the coin's power fades. Rufus is like, listen, I don't want to pressure you or anything, but you didn't open the gate. This is the full teacher-instructor mode right. Happening. It's like, I'm not trying to pressure you, okay? But I need you to open the cage. And then you got Anissa in the back, like, this guy's an idiot.
Right. Just
doesn't know how spirit coins work.
Complete dick. Just straight up.
Straight up, like, yep, we're all gonna die. I knew it, because he fucked up. And Jason's like, you're not helping. Listen, I got you.
Try again. So he uses the second coin successfully this time, and he pries the bars open, and he's out of the cage, and everyone's like, all right, do you have anything else that can help? And he's like, got some keys.
Mm-hmm. Just out of nowhere, too. It's like, well, I might have a master key. Is that
right.
helpful? Give me a coin. How about a key?
Be like in a 90s movie, just like, will these help?
Yeah. <You know? laughs> I have a spirit coin, a t-shirt, or a key ring. Which do you think would be more helpful?
Well, thankfully they chose the keys. Unthankfully, guess who makes an appearance?
Doodle.
It's our boy. And don't worry, he absolutely brought gifts for everybody. Well, Jason. And that gift is a shovel to the face, knocking him out once again.
Yes. Oh, and he's been unconscious, what, two or three times this chapter?
Yeah, like hit, yeah. And he's thrown up a lot, so his head and stomach have got to really suck at this point.
Yeah. Yes, they do. So that brings us back. Jason is now re-conscious, back in a cage, and the cage is moving. They're taking all these cages down this massive tunnel. Nisa is no longer with us. No more unhelpful comments. That'll be good.
Right. Which is because Dougal was given the opportunity to pick one of the four prisoners. He decided, I'm going to take the elf because I want to see what she tastes like.
Oh, he took it for Derek because Derek wanted to taste elf.
Ooh.
And Dougal's like, yeah, they're kind of stringy. You sure? And he's like, yeah, I've never had an elf before. And then Dougal tells Cressida, I'm going to take the elf because Derek wants to try it. She goes, is he sure? They're kind of stringy.
Right. But then she also says something along the lines of like, you know, you won't know until, you know, you'll never know until you try it. And
yeah.
And then makes some offhand comment about Landomir trying to mess with astral forces. Like, yeah, see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Too. She's like, yeah, elves are kind of stringy. It's almost like killing yourself trying to summon something. They really do not like to eat elves.
They do not. But I guess that's good for the elves?
I guess so. Oh. Mulch.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Gotta grow that hedge maze somehow.
Yeah, they do.
Oh. So, with him now being rolled away in these cages, though, it implies he has failed a quest.
Yes, he has. He has failed the escape quest, which brings me a question to you.
For me.
For you. So he, one of the quest rewards for this quest is an Awakening Stone, which he doesn't get because he fails the quest. A little later on when we get the next quest, one of the rewards for that is also an Awakening Stone. So my question is his interface giving him the same Awakening Stone in this later quest that it would have given him if he had escaped? Or is it like a completely different Awakening Stone? Like, is it randomly selected? Is it selected from a specific pool? Or is it trying to give him the same Awakening Stones?
Okay, so I think this is actually more along the lines of those, like the Fate Sensors or the Destiny Magic or whatever. In that it's kind of a multiple path situation, right? So, like, you know, we know that, you know, he has limited choices, but he has choices at this moment. Currently, those choices are limited to running his mouth, but for the most part. But either way, you know, he could have hidden, he could have, there's a few other routes he could have gone. I personally believe with the fate sensors or whatever, his interface is predictive, but it's not like all knowing, right? So maybe it's like, you know, he's going to get an Awakening Stone, but based on how he acts, how he holds himself, will dictate what he gets based on what the, you know, based on how it reads his reactions, possibly.
Honestly, that would make sense, because the Awakening Stone he gets for saving everybody is the Awakening Stone of Adventure. Mm. And he took the actions of an adventurer, and then that led him down the path of becoming an actual adventurer, so it could be tied to that. He gets the blood essence, in my opinion, because he's in a blood cave. So it could be tied to his actions, so it's going to give him an Awakening Stone. How he decides to complete that quest decides which kind of Awakening Stone he gets.
Essentially, the decisions he made possibly tipped the fate sensors off to, oh, okay, he's going to be this kind of guy, so we're going to set him on this path.
Interesting. I like
that. That's kind of how I think of it. So like, the one that he failed, the one he didn't get, you know, that one specifically doesn't matter. It's more that the choices he made led him to not getting an Awakening Stone at that point, at that quest, which could tip the, you know, quest system off to, oh, okay, what is he trying to do? Because he could have passed that quest, but he made decisions that made him not pass that quest, right?
Right. His first instinct was to free Gary, which is inevitably what ended up getting him caught and failing the quest. And so
right.
that set him on another path, like, oh, he's gonna, his first instinct is to save the other people here. And so we'll give him a quest with the bonus objective to save them and get that kind of awakening stone.
Yeah.
Ooh, I like that.
I like it. I personally kind of dig the adaptive interface kind of situation because, you know, kind of in with that, like, philosophy angle that we're looking at, your choices are what define who you are in the first place. So to me, it would make sense that, you know, Shirtaloon would write a magic system for our character that would be adaptive in a way and, you know, give him what he needs when he needs it.
Right. And that does seem to be what his magic system does throughout.
This new quest that he gets is almost like a moral philosophy test because it's, you know, primary objective, don't be sacrificed. But then there's a bonus objective to save these other people.
Right.
If he just got out, he still passes the quest. He still succeeds the quest. And I think had he done that, he would have gotten a completely different power set.
I would agree. Yes, because we know from that quest he gets the essence, the blood essence. If he took it and ran, you know, it's very possible he would get a completely different essence, like a flight essence or something in that category, be more of a stealth specialist instead of a possessing type.
And, you know, automatically he wouldn't have gotten Colin.
No, he wouldn't have gotten the adventuring awakening stone either, because that was the bonus objective.
Yeah, so literally, like, had he decided to not save the others, completely different path, completely different story.
Yeah, assuming he survived after that.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Man.
But point being...
That's crazy, yeah.
Point being that I do think it's adaptive. So, on again, and I'm gonna be on it every time. But the visuals, I love the visuals, and this next visual, dude, it's great. So basically, we have now rolled our way into the blood chamber, and like this is literally like a freaking heavy metal album, like heavy metal album cover. This is, you know, this is a Metallica album cover even. It's just crazy. I mean, it's described as boiling, you know, boiling blood, glowing red light, just this evil kind of cast on the place. And I'm pretty sure it was probably gonna be, they weren't summoning the Sanguine Horror. They were summoning Metallica. They even said the room smelled metallic. I don't think that's a coincidence.
I think it's a very high possibility. Because we know Outworlders from Earth have been in this universe before. Might have brought some Metallica with them. We know Jason certainly did later.
That would explain why Lars Ulrich is a weird drummer. Because he's just he can't be from this world. He has no music taste of this world.
Very possible. But no, you're right. This is... definitely an evil cavern. You know, it is absolutely nothing but a sacrifice chamber. You know, it is floor to ceiling, everything's red, everything's dark, everything's bloody, and it is a very intimidating looking thing to be walking into. Average day for adventurers. For Jason, he would probably be shitting himself if he had anything left to get out of his system.
Right, like could you imagine waking up tomorrow and you are automatically shoved into something that you would have only ever seen in a movie or a video game or like your nightmares. Like, right. Just a hellish hellish scene like this, that yeah, you wouldn't be able to process it.
No. No, you wouldn't. And now all four of them are in these cages in this chamber. Something I think we should talk about a little bit at this point is just the way Cressida Vane is. Because we find out they get in here and there's multiple levels into this cliff face that reaches just next to where that blood pool is. And each cage is going on its own level, going up. And the first thing that happens is they drop Gary's cage at the first level. Mm-hmm. And Cressida Vane, we see, comes up. She's like, no, leave the Leonid here. That's a heavy cave. I'm not going to make you guys drag it all the way up to the top just for fun. You know, don't worry about that. And that's
she's
like
got workplace safety standards.
She does. That's like this level of compassion that you wouldn't see from any like video game boss or from any, you know, movie or TV show villain. You know, standard bad guy procedure, like torture everybody because I'm bad. And she is showing a level of compassion here that's almost humanizing. You know, she's like, no, you're here. We're going to do the sacrifice anyway. Just leave the heavy one down here.
I mean, you could also consider it to be voganizing because it's just practical.
It is practical. It is.
It's just bureaucracy. It's just business.
It's just business.
You know, you want to keep your employees happy, not because you care about their happiness, but because bureaucracy.
Happy employees work harder.
That's exactly it.
CEOs, write that down.
Bro, they know. They know.
They know.
They don't care. They'll just make a shell company and avoid any problem if they do have a problem. It's all good. They're all good.
So I did just think of something that I want your opinion on. So they leave Jason's cage on the second level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's the second one to be dropped off. The idea is leave the heaviest cage on the bottom, take the lightest cage to the top. We know that Rufus Farah and Gary are Bronzewake adventurers.
Mm-hmm.
As you rank up, you gain density, you gain mass. Mm-hmm. So I think it's safe to say that these three people that are significantly taller, higher ranked, and obviously heavier than Jason, maybe Jason should have been on the top level? Like, he's a light dude. He's a light human for human standards. But I think it's safe to say everybody else is heavier than he is.
Right.
Right?
I hadn't even thought of that. I didn't even realize that they dropped him off at the second level. I'll be real with you.
It just occurred to me.
I didn't even know there were levels. I've completely been imagining this chamber wrong.
What?
Yeah, I thought I was viewing like there was like a ledge and a staircase down into the blood pit.
Well, there is, but then there's that ledge, there's a staircase, another ledge, a staircase, another ledge.
Yeah, no, I thought it was like one big ledge, one big staircase. I didn't pay attention to the levels.
That's fair. Yeah, four levels, everybody's on their own level. And I'm assuming that's because when the ritual is complete, the horror works its way up through the levels, gaining stronger.
Gaining stronger.
Yeah, I'm assuming the way this was supposed to go, that blood pool was supposed to fill that chamber. That's how I always imagined the appropriate ritual coming off.
That makes a lot of sense, because I just kind of viewed this as they intended, just figured it was going to be one big boss battle. Like, granted, I guess at this point they don't even know what's going to happen, so they just see crazy blood pool, red glowy light, and they're stuck in cages. Like, meh, what you going to do?
Right. We'll get into what's happening a little bit later.
So now, okay, so we're talking about the levels, right? Jason and Rufus have a conversation at this point. They're on different levels, so how is that working?
So this is as they're being transported from the tunnel up the levels. So they go through, Gary gets dropped off first. The other three continue up the stairs.
Right.
So this is happening during that transitional period.
Got you. So that makes sense. Because I was like, well, wait a minute. If they're on levels, like, how the hell does Rufus tell Jason, like, hey, do you have a gold coin on you? Like, but okay, right. So that makes sense. So then he tells Jason, like, hey, bro, you had a gold coin on you. And coincidentally, of course he does, because that's just, it's Jason, and he's already cool like that. So he pops his gold coin, you know, becomes Superman for a second, which I feel like, you know, is kind of an allusion to that Nietzsche Superman idea, at least somewhat. But it's also that first taste of real power that Jason gets.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a big difference in not only his normal rank, but the gap between silver and gold, or gold and diamond. I mean, those are gulfs. You know, it's not a gap, that's a gulf. And so that's his first taste of that power. And given that he pursues this throughout the series, like that pursuit of power and whatnot throughout the series, I would be remiss to think that this didn't play a part in his pursuit of that power, because he felt what it was like to be gold rank for just a few seconds.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, just learning about magic and then feeling the incredible effect that can have on you, right? Like, hey, magic is real. Not only is it real, I feel like I could end the world right now. Like, I have all of the power. I am seeing the universe in a brand new light. You know, that little hint is, I feel like that is always at the back of his head. Like, I remember what it feels like to be gold rank, you know? And right. I know that I can get there. I need to get there.
Now, one, I think, important thing to point out about that, though, is although he's very gung-ho about getting the power, it's never something that is expressly spoken about from him or his inner thoughts. He doesn't go, I need power, I need power. He just continuously gets power.
Yeah.
His whole inner dialogue and outer dialogue is more around what that power is doing to him.
Yeah. And the only time we ever see anything even close to I need power is when he says something like, hey, if I'm going to be fighting great astral beings and gods, I'm going to need to get stronger. You know?
Right.
And it's not even like, I need power. It's like, I made an enemy that I probably shouldn't have made at this level.
Sure.
You know, I should probably level up type of thing. So I don't think it's even a greed thing ever in the series. It's not a greed of
no,
power.
Yeah.
It's I need strength, you know?
Well, and like I said earlier, or last episode, it's the will to power, because he's not chasing the power. He's just getting the power. He's not envious of power. He's not, oh, I wish I had that power. Once in the entire series does he do that, and it's before he even understands how magic works.
And even when he does get envious of other people, it's always like superficial stuff, like, you know, cooking magic, or ooh, I wish I could eat that, or I wish I had this, you know. It's not even like anything that actually matters.
Right. It basically just food and women based envy. Yeah, like, that's about it.
It is. Or even with Rufus, like, hey, you look better than I do. Or with Taika, like, you're a delicious gumdrop. Chocolate drop.
Chocolate drop. Chocolate I was about drop. To be like, hold up. That's hold like up. One of my favorite lines.
Yeah.
He said it was a sexy chocolate drop.
Yes.
I can't wait till we get to Taika.
Oh, he's one of my favorites of all time.
We need Taika to be retconned into, like, book one.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Somebody paying attention out there.
Author. We need the Taika cut.
We need the Taika cut. Now.
Now.
So getting back to gold coins. So Jason takes the gold coin, and here's an interesting pondery for you. So we see Jason takes the gold coin because it's a stronger cage, it's reinforced magic, he needs to bust out of it. At this point, Jason, he's absorbed in essence, but he's still just a normal rank person. So why is a normal ranker able to use a gold spirit coin? You know, we see, we touch on here the difference a little bit in power between silver and gold, and how he takes the silver coin, it's like, ooh, this is a whole new world. He takes the gold coin, and it's like, I am God, you know?
Right.
And he's still normal rank. How is his body able to do that?
My thought with that is, you know, yes, he's normal rank, but he doesn't have a normal human body anymore. So his body is already compromised of just magic, right? Like, they've already said, like, he's basically just a monster with his old self inside of it, or like his memories inside of this monster. So I think it would function, you know, the same way as an essence user, just at a very, very low, obviously normal rank.
Fair. So like his body is mostly magical anyway, so it kind of allows him that little more resilience, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, Like, if you think about it, like, much later in the series, when he gets to the Astral Gate, and he starts messing with, like, that, those magical forces, like, in the same vein, like, that should have ripped him apart, but
right.
Him being who he is and what he is always finds some way out of that scenario. Like, yeah, the gold rank, like I feel like a normal ranker taking a gold coin would probably shred their body apart, but given that he's already just pure magic in some form anyway, I think it's why it has less of an effect, but still has an effect, but just less.
Got you. That makes a lot of sense. So because his body is already made of magic, he's able to absorb better that gold rank energy, which then gives him the ability to smash this door off of this cage.
And kill two goons in the process.
And kill two goons.
Freaking which combo.
It's a crazy thing, because he's expecting, like, okay, I'm a lot more powerful now, I can bend it out like I did last time. But instead, it's like a cannon. Just like, and then boom, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. And like, oh, surprised me there a little bit.
Yeah.
So after he boots these freaking dudes' heads off, he decides to, like, use his cloak, and I think this is, like, the first real in-combat use of the cloak.
I would say that's accurate, yeah.
Possibly. He doesn't use it yet the way he does in combat. In fact, he just uses it to float down to the blood pit.
Yeah, he just casts a level 1 feather falling on himself to get down.
Right.
And this is where we see the first cartoonish type of situation play out here. You know, he bolts through the door, cultists are chasing him, and then in your classic Bugs Bunny, he hides behind the door. He uses the cloak again to fade into that darkness.
So he does kind of use it. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So he uses the two non-combat abilities of it to run and hide. And loses the cultists in the process. He pulls the old double fake and then decides to go back.
Which, like we were talking about before, I think plays into how these fate sensors affect his path. Right? Like, he's choosing right now to hide, and you said run, but that's not actually accurate, because he doesn't run from this fight. He just hides, so he utilizes stealth, and his power set, and his, like, quest system, I want to say, these fate sensors, guide him towards that stealthier ability set just based on his actions in these moments like this.
Right, because he could have just charged back down the tunnel and tried to escape, but he didn't. His instinct, probably guided by these fate sensors, was to hide and let them do the running. And later on, I think in a couple chapters, he mentions that the reason he did that is because he needs the other adventurers to keep him alive while they escape.
Right.
In all honesty, I think it is just instincts. It's like, you know, oh, I cannot run these guys. I'm going to hide and free mm-hmm. these guys, which we can either chalk up to hero instinct and the fact that his path is guiding him towards being this great astral being that is the hero of all. Could also be a little bit of brain damage, you know, his
right.
Being hit with a shovel 3 times already is coming out and he's like, ah, I'm not going to run. I'm going to hide. Like all yeah. of his other instincts would be shot at this point. And he's like, let's do this.
I mean, as much as I like the head trauma theories that every media gets, this is definitely, for me, not one of those, even though I literally said that I was on team brain damage, but I'm totally not. I think no, this
in general is absolutely the instincts of a hero, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And
of these guys can help keep me alive, but like, it's the right thing to do. I need to free these guys too.
Right. And, you know, on that like philosophy talk, with this hero complex, you know, that definitely plays into that, you know, Superman idea in that as much as he needs the other adventurers to save him, like, he still feels some innate need to save them regardless. Even though he's like, I need them, I'm still gonna save them. Like, it's still part of his whole Superman identity that he ends up getting.
Right, it's the no matter how much or how little I can do, any amount of help is help.
Right. You know?
And anything that I can provide, I will provide. And that's what he does the entire series. You know, it starts right. out with, you know, I have a key that can get you out of a cage, going all the way up to, you know, repairing the Sundered Throne.
I have a key that can get you out of the dimension.
Yeah. Yeah, it goes from one key to another, man. He is the key holder.
In reference to
a person who holds keys.
I walked into that one. Okay, fair enough. Maybe you have the brain damage?
My doctor said no.
Okay, well.
My therapist said I can't help you.
You should get a second opinion.
I should.
Speaking of keys, though, as he gets out of these cages and he's now juked everybody and, like, all the cultists have run off, all right, now we're alone in the chamber and we can hurry up and try to get the friends or the newfound friends unlocked. It just turns out that the keys that he has, that he stole from Landemir, are not the keys that he needs to get their suppression collars off, because Landemir was not part of this plan.
He was not. Landemir was out doing his own thing. You know, he's like, yeah, my family's hosting a ritual, but I got one of my own, you know? And I think the whole disconnect between Landemir and the rest of the family, you know, is played out so well here, because Landemir's whole deal is he's with the Builder cult and his whole magical ritual was designed to stop the family from knowing that. And the family's like, yeah, this guy's fucking useless. Even his mom is like, he's just a weirdo. He's not really part of the family, but he is my son. So they're keeping him out of the loop while he's keeping them out of the loop. And it's all kinds of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like redheaded stepchild vibes. Like, yeah, just old Landemir. Like, just don't tell. He's doing weird stuff. Don't tell him about what we got going on here.
Yeah. Like, he shows up to dinner, I guess.
So, despite not having the keys to the collars, though, He is at least able to get everyone out of the cages. And despite not having powers, Gary, the big sexy Leonid man, can still kick some freaking ass. And we get a nice little action scene here of Jason and Gary wholesale, like, going nuts, kicking some ass. Jason punches through somebody and just, like, comes out of it with a bloody fist, still on that gold rank strength, thinking, like, oh, I'm just gonna, you know, sock this guy straight through the body, like, oh.
And you have a cavity.
Yeah. Dentist time.
Yeah.
I wanna...
And this is a crazy comparison. This is, like, the first time we get to see actual morals of Jason versus Palamustis. You know, because Jason's right. got this whole thing. He had already killed Landomir, went through a whole grieving cycle, and now he just killed another cultist. You know, and he didn't just kill them, he absolutely dominated them. And it's not something that he's used to, and he doesn't like the idea of killing people. And, you know, Gary, growing up in this world, being an adventurer, you know, understands that sometimes people have to die. And it helps, it really helps to be better at killing than the people who are trying to kill you. You know?
Yeah.
And we see that play out here. Jason's like, you know, killing them doesn't make us better than they are. And Gary's like, well, yeah, it does. It makes us better at killing.
I know. I love that. Like, Jason's having, like, full-on, like, standard Earth, like, moral dilemmas about what's going on here. And Gary is just like, that was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole dynamic between Gary and Jason here, I find one of the best, at least in book one. You know, because right from the beginning, their relationship is, it's a little comedic, but it's got that immediate bond feel to it. Because, you know, they're going up the stairs, they're freeing the rest of the party. Jason is letting Gary do the work and trying not to die, you know. Mm-hmm. And the whole way, Gary's like, man, you were a genius. You're, like, pretending to be all pathetic and weak and then completely making them underestimate you. And Jason's like, nope, I'm pathetic and weak. You need to do the killing.
Right.
The connection is not being made, you know.
That spot specifically, he distracted them by begging not to die. Like, literally, please don't kill me. And Gary straight up was like, great diversion, good idea. And yeah. He's like, I wasn't lying. I didn't want to die.
Yeah. Which I find, it's not important to mention, but I find it interesting to mention that after he begs for his life, Jason goes with the classic nut punch.
For real.
It's like, hey, this works in my world. And
works anywhere.
In Palamustis, as we know now.
That brings me back to the Bobaverse, how like pretty much every character or every species that they meet ends up getting punched in the solar plexus because it's just a universal and there's always going to be like a diaphragm to punch, basically.
Yeah, and it works every time.
Every single time. So this is nut punch, diaphragm, it's all the same. It's all
the same, yeah.
Weak spots. You know, a spider's weak spot's always going to be its legs and its eyes.
Yeah.
Every video game ever.
Every game, yeah. One of these days we're going to run into a Shab, and it's going to be armored around the eyes and the legs, and nobody's going to know how to fight it.
Oh, yeah. How would you fight it? It'd be invincible.
You'd have to run, yeah. So you go for the leg is armored. Well, we give up.
You just go down to your basement one day and there's like just a little wolf spider running around in like plate armor, like, oh hell no.
Yeah. That's time to
they're evolving. It's time to leave the planet. The minute spiders develop plate armor and start growing in size, we are fucked.
We're calling Elon immediately. Like, I will give you anything you want, get me to Mars now.
What if he's like, I want a spider with plate armor?
We're dead.
No, just get a bowl. Here you go.
Armor, meat bowl.
And then they launch us into space while Elon takes over the world with armored spiders.
As long as I'm not there, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, but we're going to be dying in the vacuum of space. He's not launching us anywhere. He's going to launch us like the Tesla car. Maybe in a Tesla car.
I don't know, man. As long as it's not a Dyson, we're fine.
What? What's a vacuum? Vacuum
of space. Dyson, if you're listening, new commercial idea. Dyson, the vacuum of space. 3034, that's gonna be a thing. When we're all living in space apartments, that's gonna be a thing.
Dog, I don't know if humanity's gonna be around in another 1,000 years at this point.
Yeah, we are. It's gonna happen. It has to happen.
Do you know what else has to happen?
What?
Rufus being sexy as fuck.
Yes, it does. It's one of life's universal constants.
Yeah, so like I think at this moment, Jason like sees Rufus, I think, changing his clothes, or he's doing something.
No, they just get him out of the cage.
That
Rufus has to do is get out of a cage. Look like Act 3 superhero movie.
For real, and Jason's just like, oh, well, he's sexy as hell. Which I think is great.
That's not fair.
It is not fair. But as we know, Jason's just normal rank. He's not sexy yet.
That's true. Bronze rank. And let's be real, Rufus was probably looking this good without essences. And now he's got essences.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like the same thing, like how they describe like Rufus and Sophie as being like naturally already like hot, like they'd be a 10, like a normal 10. So like they get like ridiculously hot when they rank up.
Yeah. Which I'd like to mention at this point, Rufus throughout the entire series, we're in chapter 11, right? 11 chapters in to a 12 book series. And Rufus will continuously be one of the sexiest people in the cosmos.
I cannot argue with that.
Yeah. He's also bald. Clean shaven. He's got no hair.
What's your point?
Sex appeal. Let's sex appeal. Sex appeal. Let's hit it. Hair doesn't mean sexy. Why doesn't Rufus have hair? Wouldn't that make
That is a conscious decision by Rufus.
No. He's constantly telling us how he doesn't wax his head.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Throughout the whole series, that's a joke. And I think it stands up.
Except for in book 11, when he then decides to go to Earth and grow his hair out.
They've got an ointment for that. Tori's hair growth ointment. Jason uses it quite frequently. Shade has.
He's on Earth now
because it grows everywhere.
He's on Earth now. Ain't no Jory.
But he's got access to Jason before he leaves.
Did Jory go to Earth? Who went to Earth? We'll get to that later, probably.
We'll figure that out. We'll have this conversation a little later. I'm just saying, bald equals sexy doesn't mean hair.
Maybe secondary video. Would you guys want to see us cover other topics, just covering the wider He Who Writes with Monsters, He Who Fights with Monsters? Would you guys rather see us covering topics, you know, in the wider world of the He Who Fights with Monsters series? Or y'all okay with just the chapter by chapter? Let us know down below. Anyway,
with Rufus freed from the cage.
Rufus?
It's like Rufus, but in an accent.
Sorry, we're not going to leave that in. Take that one again.
So we've got Rufus freed from the cage. We've got Gary applauding Jason for being weak and pathetic. And we've got Jason feeling bad about himself.
And applauding Rufus for being sexy.
True.
At this point, though, Jason doesn't have a whole lot of time to feel bad about himself because the cultists come right back in and it's about to be fight time again. And we are limited on powers and abilities all around, but we do have something. We have a suspicious something.
A suspicious something indeed.
A suspiciously sharp object of sorts?
Possibly. Could this object be, perchance, a trowel?
No, it's a chopstick.
I was so close.
Of course, it's the trowel, this suspiciously sharp thing. And we get treated to a scene of Rufus, the master swordsman, in his first display of swordsmanship in the series, fighting with a trowel.
Yes, and he is and fighting in a mini boss fight here with the daughter of Cressida Vane. You know, obviously Elisa knows who Rufus is. Rufus knows who she is. And this is before we even know that Rufus is, like, the master swordsman of this world, right underneath his grandfather. And the visual of, you know, Alicia on the high ground with her sword, which I imagine to be, like, rapier-type sword.
Right, same, same.
Yeah, and then Rufus sitting there with his trowel. That's not a trowel, but that's his size. Just full sword fight with a trowel is absolutely insane. It just shows the level of skill that Rufus has. And we can imagine if he had a sword, this battle would have been over 2 seconds.
For sure. Is this... Do they mention in this spot that, like, Alicia had wanted to fight Rufus because he was... You know, the master swordsman or the grandson of the master swordsman. Is this the spot where they mention that? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because Alicia's like, I've always wanted to cross swords with the great Rufus Remore.
Yeah, yeah. And we're like, yeah. So we're like, oh, he's fancy, but he's got just a garden spoon, basically.
Right. Which is crazy, because if I'm, even as an even evil villain, you know, if I'm like, I have always wanted to cross swords with this man, maybe give him a sword to cross with. It's like, aha, you're unarmed. It's even. Like, my guy.
My guy, right? Pretty much. Speaking of trowels, we get a epic moment in Palamustis sports history right here. Cressida Vane comes in the middle of this battle to interrupt, and she's like, yo, y'all, knock it off. Rufus chucks the trowel up in a layup to Gary, who then sends it through the throat of Alicia.
Yes. Just the and perfect practice teamwork that they've got going on.
100% team synergy. Very important. And this team, very specifically good at it. Especially when they get all their powers together and synergize. It's good stuff.
It is, dude. It is a beautiful moment that we've all been waiting for. We don't get that for several books, but it's amazing. And the fact that they have just this non-communication, you know, yep, here you go. I know exactly what to do with that. You know, it just shows right. how long they've been working together. And it's probably the most badass thing any trowel on Earth could ever experience.
Right, like...
Possibly like, on Palamustis. I'd imagine with magic, there's a lot of badass things that they can do with it, but I guarantee you that trowel was having the time of his life.
I mean, yeah, he's gonna write home about that one.
Yeah.
Now, this spot felt really weird to me, because Cressida gets really mad about them killing Alicia, but, like... openly mentioned earlier that, like, I really wish I didn't have kids. I wouldn't have had kids. She doesn't like her kids, but then, like, both of her kids die, and she's, like, pissy about both of them dying, and it's like, well, maybe there's a little unresolved family trauma there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, both of my kids are useless. Like, if it weren't for the cult, I never would have had kids anyway. You know, she mentions that her husband's an idiot, too. She just had a lot of family issues. But then she's like, I'm very attached to my kids. Jason's going to lose his soul in this sacrifice. Rufus is going to be tormented for having done this. And it's like, you didn't like them anyway. What's the point? Like, what's the big deal here? Why don't you just die? Let's have you die too. And
everything. Right. But we do see that, like, Cressida's whole thing in general, beyond her kids, beyond the cults. Well, actually, I mean, all of it kind of plays into it, but it's just she is way more interested in political power. Yeah. And it's funny that she is going against Jason, who has zero reverence for religious or political power whatsoever. Like, literally, Jason is standing up to and literally laughing in the face of these people who are much, much more powerful than him at this current time. Which, again, on the Superman ideology, it's what he does the entire series, is just stands up and laughs in the face of power.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what she's concerned about here, you know. A lot of her family issues, I feel like, are involved in the fact that she's not holding the position in the Red Table that she wants. You know, and on some level, she might blame her family for that, you know. Like, she's just seen as the mother figure, not the high priestess of the Red Table figure. You know, but...
Right.
And in all of these ways, you know, Jason picks up on it. And I think it's funny that Jason doesn't care about, you know, the politics of any situation, considering on Earth he studied in political sciences and he knows his way around a political situation better than anybody else I know, you know, fictional or non-fictional. And he's like, yeah, I don't care about politics, but I know how they operate.
So I feel like that could kind of play into that whole, like, Dunning-Kruger effect. About, like, you know, like, you know, when you don't know a lot about something, you're really confident. And then you learn more, you get very unconfident. And then the more you learn, you slowly regain that confidence, right? But... So for Jason, I'm assuming, you know, and we can just from context with how he is with his politics, very likely had the very similar, like, blast into politics at a young age, then realize, oh, I don't really know enough about this, lose all confidence in politics, and then finally, as he learned more about it, realized, oh, there's not much I really care about any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see that being the way he is, you know, and we see that a little bit on Palamuses too, because, you know, politics are similar, but they work a little different when magic is involved, you know, and you, especially with this medieval political system with the corruption that they have in Kingstone, you know, it's like, I know a lot about my politics, and the areas of this he doesn't know about, he is full on arrogance and confidence. You know, he shows a lot of overconfidence in the areas he doesn't know and just turns that dial. He maxes out his confidence. Like, I'm going to fake it till I make it because I know enough to know how to sound like I know enough.
Right. And that's Dunning-Kruger all day, every day. And everyone experiences that all day, every day.
Yeah.
Now, when he is, you know, being overconfident at this specific moment, he kind of notices that there's a major commonality in Earth and Palamustis's political systems in that they're very sexist.
They are.
So Cressida Vane, on the sole fact of being a woman, is not the leader of the Blood Cult, even though she is infinitely more qualified, infinitely more, I'd say evil, but like, I don't know, I guess vindictive, sinister, maybe. She's just a lot more sinister. And her name alone is a lot more intimidating than Daryl Carruthers.
Yes. Yes. No, it's straight up like Lady Cressida Vane.
Daryl Carruthers.
Right, like, I'm High Priest Daryl Carruthers.
It's like, wait, your name is Daryl? You heard of my greatness. Like, no. No. Listen to yourself.
Daryl Carruthers.
But and Jason plays this up. He's like, he knows that the whole no women in politics is really getting under Cressida's skin, because whose skin wouldn't it get under, right? Especially sitting next to Daryl over here.
You know? Right.
And his awareness of this allows him to pretty swiftly pit the two against each other. He's like, oh, you didn't want a woman in charge, did you? And Daryl does the basic Jason response. It's like, stop talking nonsense. And right. The rest of it is like, hold up, he's got a point, motherfucker.
He should have just brought the shovel out one more time. It's the only thing that can stop Jason. A shovel to the face. That's it.
Where's Dougal? He should have been assigned to watch Jason 24/7. The only thing that actually stops Jason is Dougal with a shovel.
That's it.
That's the only
thing. And that's actually where the builder messed up. Because, yes, he did inhabit Dougal as a vessel. But he didn't have a shovel with him.
He tried
to fight Jason with words and not shovels. And we've seen the only thing that can stop Jason is a shovel. So, moving forward, shovels are what is needed. Because if you don't bring a shovel, what happens? Jason's going to do something stupid, gain some level of power, and fuck you up. And wrapping up the end of this chapter, and before we get to the final little dialogue about the end of this episode, it's exactly what happens. He pops another gold coin too early, by the way. He just does it. Like, meh, send it. Pop it. Forget the mana poisoning. And automatically blasts Cressida and Daryl straight dead into the blood pit. And that's where we're going to leave today, because they've just triggered the Sanguine Horror Ritual.
Yes, they did. And this is the perfect time to leave off. Let you guys ponder this for a week or two. Maybe a month. Let's wait a month before the Sanguine Horror shows up. But yes, these chapters were absolutely incredible. Even though Jason spent most of the time in a cage and unconscious, you know, we get to see a little bit of Jason's hero complex. And you know, thinking about it through this whole escape scene that we have going on, you know, most of the fighting is done by Rufus and Gary and a little by Dougal, but you know, without Jason, none of this really would have been possible. Oh, I was saying that Jason is like the thermostat in an engine, you know, it's this tiny little piece. The engine does all the work, but without the thermostat, none of it works at all. And so Jason is like that tiny little pathetic thing that makes the whole thing operational. And this is where we see Jason have value, not as an adventurer or as an astral king, but as just being himself.
Mm-hmm. You know,
being in the right place at the right time. That's where his value comes from.
Right. And yeah, dude, that's a really good point. Because that's, I mean, essentially, like, how the World Phoenix uses him. He's just this seemingly inconsequential piece. And then all of a sudden, he gets way beyond what World Phoenix even intended for him. And was like, oh, no. This little piece is way more pivotal than I imagined.
Yeah. And this is the very start of that. This is where we see that start to take form and take shape.
Yeah.
And lead us into the great astral being he will one day become.
Yeah, and I mean that is intense, and it's fun to think about all these little things that Jason does that are seemingly inconsequential but have massive effects in not only just Palamustis, but like in space, in the astral world, in the freaking, like, in the hierarchy of gods and astral beings, like this little thermostat is the little thermostat that could.
It is, too. and it's beautiful.
So, I love that. I love little thermostat Jason boy. And he's about to really be utilized as a thermostat because things are about to heat up in our next episode. It's going to be the Sanguine Horror episode. Rituals popping off, big battles, and we're really launching into the monsters that Jason is fighting in this He Who Fights With Monsters podcast.
Yes, that's a weird thing. Yes, we'll see a little bit of magic. We'll see some combat. We'll see some Jason. And it's going to be a good time. So,
it's going to be a good time.
We'll get into some action. In the meantime, I've been Donnie B.
And I've been D. Allen.
And find us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all your good stuff.
We're on the things.
We're on all the things.
All right.
We'll see you next
time. Catch you guys next week.
Wish people could see our little floating screens on the side.
I know, right?